Can we start the recording, please? Thank you. Well, welcome back. Good afternoon, everybody. This is still the first day of the ALAC and Regional Leadership Working Session 1. We've had a very short lunch, which looked a little bit more like a marathon to try and get the food and come back. That's why we're a little bit late, so apologies to those people who are listening to us remotely. We have with us the honor of having Maggie Sarad, Senior Director of Contractual Compliance, with us. And next to her is Pam Little. And both of them will be able to answer our questions with regards to anything to do compliance-wise. There is a presentation on the screen, which I guess, is it Maggie?
Yes.
Maggie will be taking us through. And so, Maggie, the floor is yours.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for this opportunity. Actually, you are our first presentation for the week. So with me in the room, as Olivier mentioned, I have Pam Little. We also have a new team member with us who joined us recently, sitting in the back, is Jack Kawaja. On the phone, we should have Khalil Rashid, whom many of you have worked with over the past few years. We also have many of other team members participating because we consider this as one of the forums that are very critical to our success. You represent a stakeholder group that is very critical to the success of our mission and vision. So let me walk you a little bit how we're going to present. We have very general updates based on the interests that you have shared with us in the past, but we also have received questions. So the first thing I would like to thank the ALAC community for providing us your question in a professional, timely manner, allowed us to address them, and we have some slides that will address to those. We also have a list of a very extensive list of questions slash tickets or complaints that was submitted to us that I have prepared a summary to kind of give you an idea what is it we're looking at. Next slide, please. So who's driving the slides? All right, next, please. So, gosh, this is too far, can't see. All right, so the questions for the audience, the first one was about the organization. The second one was about updates on our website that concerned notices. And the third is a category of 177 questions received. And we grouped them in what we called bulk submitted complaints and the same question regarding updates to notices. So we are on slide 4. So question one regarding the compliance organization, I'm very happy to announce to the ALAC community we are 4 new team members stronger than when we saw you in Dakar. I know. Hey, listen, I'm dancing, not just clapping. So it takes a while. If you've ever worked in the compliance world, finding the right talent is very important. But if you've ever worked in the compliance world that I can, that's a double whammy. Finding the role, finding the diversity, finding the right skill sets to be able to work in this environment and address the concerns. The internet is moving a lot faster than any one of us could have ever imagined. So 4 new team members, and we are combined now. We can cover 7 languages. So we're very pleased. The way we're building our organization, this is not the end, please. Do not think so. I have additional headcounts approved, and we are still pursuing to grow the team further. The way we are pursuing our growth is based on the volume of the growth and the concerns in the community in the areas. So at our organization, I am the head of the department. And we have a core team we refer to as our core registry compliance team. We are building our staff to be able to address and be cross-functional and working in any venue as needed based on the volume, based on the urgency, based on the demands. We also have hired Jack, whom we introduced to you earlier. He is coming to us with years of experience in risk and audit management, which is very important. You know, we don't want to just say we're running audits. Why we're doing the audits? Which risks are we addressing? What are we going to do with them? So over the next few months, and we'll keep you updated in the future, how we're progressing, what's our strategy. But most important is our commitment to keep it going, momentum and delivery. The fourth category is a gentleman by the name of Paul. And Paul joins us with years of experience, not only in performance management and reporting and dashboards and KPIs and metrics, you name it, he's done it. And so today I can strongly stand here and assure you the team is much stronger and much more capable than it had been since I joined. So we are growing and we continue to deliver to that commitment of growth from the resources. Resources alone are not enough, so we have got a lot more things we'll update you on. The second question that came to us was about updates. If you've ever looked at our compliance webpage, I don't know how you could have traversed it. It was good. It had good, valuable information. We've worked hard to turn it to a more user-friendly webpage where you can traverse it based on the importance, based on it from a consumer, community perspective, not an ICANN staff perspective. So we've attached the link here, and I don't know who's running the show, but if you click on the link, not necessarily today, but you will go to the compliance webpage, you'll notice we've added lots of information, and you have our commitment to keep it updated, up to date. We also started to deliver a brief, I don't want to call it a newsletter, guys. I want to call them updates, even though they fall in the newsletter section. They are very brief today, but we are finalizing on some of our reports because we don't want to just report volume. We want to bring some more valuable data to you, and you'll see that in the future. Now, for the next question, Q3, which is slide 6, and a couple of slides from there, I would like to turn the mic over to Khalil, who is the senior manager for Who Is Area and the UDRP. Khalil's been with us for many years, has worked within the community and knows about it and is leading it. So I'll give him that courtesy. Khalil, are you on the phone?
Hello, hello.
Okay. So the questions in this space, while Khalil unmutes, are based on the different complaints we received in the 177 category of questions. So we have some updates. Some of you who participated in the pre-meeting may have seen a slide or two, but we want to dive into some of the areas to give you an update. Khalil?
Hello,
okay.
You guys hear me now?
Okay.
Hello, hello.
We can hear you. Go ahead, Khalil.
Sounds good. Sorry about that. Thank you, Maggie, and welcome everyone in Costa Rica. One of the things I want to do today, in addition to addressing the particular complaint, is give a broad overview of compliance activities during the last trimester as relates to Who Is Accuracy, Who Is Access, and the UDRP. The UDRP doesn't so much touch your group, but still it's important to understand what we've been doing. So with respect to Who Is Accuracy, as you know, that's one of our primary Who Is compliance functions, determining whether registrars are actually complying with their responsibility to take reasonable steps to investigate Who Is inaccuracies. So if you look at the slide, during the last trimester, we received about roughly 9,000 or so Who Is inaccuracy complaints in total. We resolved about 6,445 through the automated compliance processes. This is where we complaints are resolved without interaction from actual compliance staff. So the registrars receive the complaints, and the registrars take action in a time frame where we don't have to get involved, which is the ideal way it should work. As you may or may not know, when complaints, Who Is Inaccuracy complaints are filed, registrars do not have an obligation to actually contact the complainant. And in some cases, they can't because we allow through our system some Who Is Inaccuracy complaints to be filed anonymously. It's actually the choice of the complainant. So sometimes, or actually most times, you will never hear back from a registrar when you file a Who Is Inaccuracy complaint. That's not to say that the registrar has not taken their responsibility and actually resolved it. And in addition, what we're doing is actually revising our who is an accuracy complaint process to make it more efficient and to streamline our efforts. So what we want to know is whether or not registrars are taking the reasonable steps at the front end and not just when compliance gets involved. This is that roughly 25 to 30% where they're not resolved to the system. We want them to show us up front what steps they're taking to resolve who is an accuracy. If you could all go to the next slide, please. I don't think I can. Another thing that we're doing in compliance is looking at the volume of registrar who is an accuracy complaints and where they come from. So we want to address now more the systematic issues related to who is an accuracy. For years, we've sort of just seen them come in, looked at whether registrars are taking their responsibilities and doing what they need to do. But now we're actually trying to find out, okay, where is the systematic who is problem located, which registrars, and how we can work directly and more effectively with those registrars to address these issues. Now, with respect to complaints and registrars by location, as you can see, most complaints still arise in North America and Europe. I mean, that should be no surprise because they have the bulk of the share of domain name registration. So it may not be totally indicative of registrar who is an accuracy, particularly since the domain name system is global, but we are trying to take a more systematic look and see how we can address this at a core foundation. Another thing we actually do is look into who is access. If we can go to the next slide, please. Maybe not. So one of the things that registrars are required to do, or among the many, is provide access to WHOIS data. There's two primary ways. One is through a Port 43 WHOIS service, and another is interactive web page. What we've tried to do in compliance is determine whether or not registrars are providing this access, and we've tried to get a little bit more creative with how we do it. In 2009, we actually revamped our system and started pinging and querying registrar WHOIS servers on a daily basis. Since that time, we've actually taken them off of standard ICANN-related IP addresses, and now we run those queries automatically to prevent registrar gaming, et cetera. So if you look at the slide, what you can see is during this past trimester, we detected 29 cases of registrars who appear to not be providing that access through their Port 43 service. And so when we do that, we actually have a process which we use to make that determination. We actually receive a notification that a WHOIS access is down, we may not act right away because it could be some other issue, network traffic, et cetera. In fact, the next slide sort of speaks to that. But of those 29 cases where we determined there was a reason for compliance to get involved, 7 resolved before we even had the opportunity to get involved, meaning WHOIS access was restored via Port 43. 19 actually we resolved during our convention process, which we streamlined to make more effective and sort of prevent registrar gaming. We still have a few issues that we're working through with registrars, but on par and overall, we've been pretty impressed with how registrars have provided WHOIS access in light of our enhanced compliance procedures in this area. If we could go to the next slide, it actually explains why sometimes it may appear that registrars are not providing WHOIS access, but in fact, they actually are. I won't read the slide off, but for the benefit of those there, you can kind of see. So there are several reasons why we won't necessarily get immediately involved when a registrar appears to not be providing WHOIS access, and some of those reasons are listed there. So moving right along, we also do our UDRP compliance. The UDRP is a policy that registrars must comply with to prevent trademark infringement. So when an arbitration panel, and there's 4 of them, have adjudged that a domain name violates or infringes a trademark, the registrar must implement that decision and either transfer the domain name to the trademark holder or cancel the domain name. So we have a specific application set up where when complainants have received favorable decisions that have not been implemented by the registrar, the complainant can come to ICANN, and ICANN compliance will actually take compliance prevention process steps to make sure that the registrar implements the decision or ultimately, if they do not, issue a breach notice. I think since I've been at ICANN, we have issued 2 notices of breach for registrar failure to comply with the UDRP. During this past trimester, I believe we had 16 cases. Most of those were able to be resolved once we commenced our prevention process and the registrar ultimately implemented a decision. There's also a clause in the UDRP 4K, which is designed to respect the jurisdiction of courts throughout the world, where the respondent or the alleged infringer, if they receive a non-favorable decision, they can challenge that decision in a court pursuant to the UDRP process. And we found that one case that actually did occur where the respondent decided to invoke their right to challenge the UDRP. And so that was no longer a compliance issue when we found that out. But in addition to that, we also received UDRP complaints through our general complaint ticketing system. And 95% of these do not actually relate to UDRP compliance in terms of ICANN-related responsibilities. In fact, our UDRP compliance is very limited to registrars not implementing decisions or registrars not complying with the process. ICANN particularly does not and should not be involved in determining whether trademarks are violating or being violated by domain names. So with that said, there's one additional thing that I wanted to address, and then we can open up for questions now or later, depending on what you guys see fit, and that is the registrar website obligation. Under the 2001 and 2009 RAA, registrars are required to provide interactive access to WHOIS data via a website. However, they can actually subcontract their responsibility, but they remain fully liable for fulfilling the obligation to do so. So sometimes if a registrar does not have a direct website but links to another website, we've determined that that is actually compliant with the contractual process. However, registrars under the 2009 RAA, accredited under that one, are actually required to provide a mailing address and an email address on their website. So sometimes you may have to look to which accreditation agreement the registrar is accredited under to understand their responsibilities when it comes to websites. So with that said, if there's questions, we can address them now or later. I'm not in the room, so it's kind of hard to
Khalil,
where things are going. Yeah.
We'd like to hold the questions because to the end, please.
Sure.
So continuing with our general update based on the previous meetings to keep you informed about our activities. So we talked about additional resources. Now on slide 13, want to update the audience of this slide you've seen in the past, but what does it mean to us as a community? I'm not saying ICANN staff, ICANN community. It's basically we're trying to roll out what we call the culture of compliance to everybody. We are all important in this culture of compliance, and we are in the phase of doing what we call a pilot phase for self-assessments. What does that mean? Basically, based on the contractual obligations of the different contracted parties, we've created self-assessment questionnaire where we are now we've finished piloting the registrars. We're closing on the registry self-assessment. What we hope to learn from this self-assessment, many things. Is the tool doable? Are the questions and the facts being requested clear, understood by all? But I also want to look at it from a compliance perspective. What kind of data we're getting? What does it look like? How consistent is it? How valuable it is for us to do with it? So all this will fall into what we refer to our audit strategy and our risk strategy. But we're pilot testing this trimester, and before the next meeting, in the June meeting, we hope to have a summary to this audience about what did we learn, lesson learned from this pilot, and what are the steps we're taking. Along this line, now slide 14, again, resources is many things, people, systems, processes, tools. We are very proud to announce to this audience and across all the different presentations we're doing this week, we have successfully completed review of our processes across all different areas of compliance. This today, if you are familiar with process mapping, doesn't look like a swim lane on all this, but this is the overall compliance process. What that means is no matter what contracted party we're looking at, no matter what provision, who is, UDRP, accuracy, no matter what, the process will follow the same. We receive through the intake system, it could be a tool, it could be the current systems we have, it could be emails, phone calls. No matter what an inquiry or a notice or a complaint is sent our way, it comes through what we call the preventive phase. Again, the preventive phase is about monitoring, audit, looking at what is being reported to us. If it's clear and it's according to the contractual obligations, we follow with what we call the three-step rule. First step is an inquiry where we ask or we send a notice. Again, it depends if there's clarity or not. If there's no clarity, we send an inquiry for proof, and then we pursue it. The point is this three-step, it's clearly defined across all and has been communicated to the contracted parties. We send through an email. We don't hear from them or there's not enough valid response. We follow up within that time frame based on the contractual agreement, but sometimes also based on the complexity of the area we're addressing. We follow up with an email and a phone call. We are all bombarded with emails. We don't want to just take that for granted. If by that date we still have not heard, we follow with an email, phone call, and a fax. So we've really addressed the different means of communication with the contracted party. If by the third notice we have not heard, we turn this hot potato around in 2 business days. The team is internally challenging ourselves now. How can we turn this hot item into a breach notice so we can inform the community immediately what's going on? And our commitment to this community, and it's one of the many questions that came our way, is publishing on the website is one thing, but how do you keep it updated? So we've figured it out, and we've got the resources focused on maintaining that update. What you're going to notice in this is under enforcement now, once a breach notice has been issued and the period expired, there is no proof of curing the breach or a very minimum effort was done. We have a process that has been developed this past trimester, leveraging a provision in the 2009 RAA, where we now do suspension process. Currently, there is a registrar today under suspension, and they have a certain very specific time frame they have to cure the breach by. If not, then it will be suspension till termination. So the idea of this process, again, it doesn't matter what area you're coming from, which contracted party, it's following clearly and consistently across. We've standardized all the templates, all the communication, all the things we're asking for. So before we go to the next slide, this area of improvement is going to be most effective in the upcoming meetings where we start reporting to you. And we're asking in the process, as Khalil said on the call, for more facts. We looked at our processes. Are we being efficient and effective in what we're asking? How many times do we loop back and forth before we have facts to speak to and make decisions based on? We've moved it all to the front line, and we hope to start communicating and reporting back to the community on this effort.
Okay, so in this slide, I would like to share with the ALEC community how compliance also play an important role in policy development and the whole policy process. As many of you are participating in making policies, basically compliance, its role is implementing or enforcing those policies. But so that's a kind of a full circle. But we are very much involved in the policy development process as well. For example, many of you might have noticed the IRTP Part B working group has actually worked very hard and long time, implement or recommended all those changes. The changes are going to become effective from 1st of June 2012. In about 3 months. There are substantial changes there. And we have been very involved in that process. We provided the compliance data to the working group, informing them the training, where the problems lie. We were even involved in proposing, drafting, commenting on proposed policy changes. It's kind of full, as I said, closed the whole policy cycle. We are very involved from policy development as well as policy change, and then we enforce the policy. We also were involved in the fake renewal notices drafting team's work. Many of you probably will be following that work as well, because this was a recommendation coming out of the REP working group, the Registration Abuse Policy Working Group's identify this issue as a concern to the community. So the drafting team was formed to report to the GNSL how to address this problem, and we have been working quite closely with the drafting team. We responded to their questions. We provided feedback to the options they proposed. We even recommended other options they didn't consider. The other thing we were involved was the GNSO's response to REP working group's recommendation on a meta issue, which is the uniformity of reporting. I think the REP working group recognized different stakeholder groups, different community groups have different methods of tracking violation or abuse, and was trying to explore the need to have some sort of uniformity in that area. And so their recommendation to the GNSO was firstly to request some information from the compliance team to find out how the compliance team track and report on contract violation and abuses. So these are just examples to show you we are not only involved in the enforcement of policy, but also that policy development process. Next slide, please. This slide I would like to share with the community about registry compliance activities, and from the demographic that you can see, most registries are in North America and in Europe. There's one in Asia. We have contractual requirements for registry to provide monthly reports, and from those reports they provided, you can see in those areas they are all compliant with the DNS availability requirement, the WHOIS availability requirement, and providing equal access to all registrars to their shared registration system. And we also have not received during the reporting period, which is September to November 2011, any incident or problem regarding denial of bulk access to zone file. Next slide, please. This slide, I would like to share with you the geographic or demographic locations of the source of complaints we received. From October 2011 to February 2010, compliance received a total of 16,741 complaints, and these are the geographic distribution. 1% of complaints we could not really track where they come from. When I say where they come from means the complaints are against registrars located in that geographic location, region. Next slide, please. And this is to give you an overview of the different types of complaints we get. These are really sort of the major buckets of complaints we receive. From this chart, you can see out of those 16,000, who is the most voluminous complaints, right? 9,500. But we also receive a large number of complaints that concern customer service issues provided by registrars. Those complaints, usually we really don't have authority to address, but they are, as you can see, over 4,000 complaints concerning those issues. Next biggest item is transfer issues. And as many of you know, we spend enormous amount of time trying to address this area. And there are other areas such as data escrow, UDRP, which Khalil touched upon. We also received 3 complaints from the law enforcement community as well. Out of those complaints in different areas, as Khalil mentioned, a lot of them would resolve without compliance intervention, but sometimes they do require compliance intervention. And Maggie just introduced to you this 3-strike rule. If we see a potential compliance issue in that complaint, we would send the first notice or first inquiry to the registrar and then gradually move to second and third. And if that doesn't get resolved, we have an internal referral process from preventative unit to the enforcement unit, where the enforcement unit will be issuing a breach of notice to the contracted party concerned. So we have issued two breach notices in T2, trimester 2, and one notice of suspension. And you'll see those on our website. We had no termination or non-renewal. These slides actually sort of go deeper into show the data about the registrar demographics versus complaints and volumes and where registrars are. There is a detailed description of how this means, this chart means. You will see the first one, let's take for example North America as a region. You can see that region has 95.6 million of domain registration, and it received 3,939 complaints, or 3,939 complaints actually concern registrars in that region. And they are, then you'll see at the bottom, is 600. They are 683 registrars in that region, but there are 117 complaints concerning those registrars. So from those percentage, you can probably see some sort of trending, you know, where are the most customer complaints, consumer complaints, all those complaints we get most prevalent. Or and this is one of the things Maggie mentioned. We try to be more creative and more smart in what we do, so we can actually identify problem areas or address problems more effectively. Next slide, please. Again, this is what we just said earlier. I mentioned earlier about transfer being one of the biggest complaint items we received. So we just aggregate all the complaints in T2. We come up with the top five registrars that have most transfer complaints against them. And we know who they are. We know where they are. And we want to be able to... We are doing this so we can address the problem more effectively. As, you know, the jargon is like, these are the low-hanging fruit. If we can tackle those registrars, help them to understand the transfer policy, their obligations, how to make changes to become compliant, we could reduce the number of complaints and hopefully, you know, that would make the consumer or the user experience better. This is what we're doing in terms of transfer. The next one is about who is. Again, we do the similar thing. We identify who are the top 10 registrars that our who is inaccuracy complaints are concerned about. So these are the registrars, and you can see in T2, the number one would have received over 1,200 complaints. Again, we are addressing this so we can work with these registrars more directly and proactively to identify root causes and address the problem. So that was just a high level about the key areas we are working on or new initiatives, doing it differently and doing it more effectively. So I'll turn to questions.
Thank you very much. And the floor is open, and I can see many hands coming out. So we'll start with Bo, then we'll have Holly, then Evan, and then Garth. So first, Bo. You have to wave it, Cheryl. And so you'll be appended. Go ahead, Bo.
I have three questions. I'll make them brief. I'm guessing, it looks like you do, but I mean, do you keep historical data and do you use it? And by that, I mean, what patterns have you identified? And I think you may have been alluding to that with that slide where all the names were blocked out by the yellow box. If you could go back to that so we could actually see those names. Next. Yeah. Who are they? Can you take the yellow thing off that slide?
No, we cannot, because as we shared with you, the high-level process, communicating to the public does not happen unless it's an enforcement phase. But to answer your previous question, now, as I mentioned at the beginning, with the additional staff members, different focus areas, we have historical data and we're looking at them.
I still have one more question, okay. And that is, it occurs to me that a lot of the stuff that looks like you're trying to do here is very similar to the U.S. Better Business Bureau and how it groups numbers of complaints and analyzes them based on how many have been resolved or whatever. I mean, do you do any of that, or do you just log numbers? And, I mean, seems to me that you're talking about, you know, a lot of pie in the sky about what kind of data that you're going to collect or what you're hoping to collect or you have collected, but not a lot that I hear that talks about what you're going to do with it in a way that makes sense to consumers. So if you, you know, if you can help or if you can suggest any sort of way that we can get some information that looks like, you know, here are the 10 worst registrars for complaints. Okay, that information should be publicly available if it's not. It needs to be publicly available right now.
So I can take the first part of your question, Bo. What do we do with this data? We put the objective of what is it we are doing with the data internally. We are taking it directly with a contracted party. We are addressing root causes, and based on each root cause, whether it's education or it's truly a non-compliance behavior, we follow the process, and publishing will happen when it's in enforcement phase. So we are not just reporting. You know, in the past, we used to report volume. Now we're looking at the data differently.
Thank you. Next is Holly.
I've got two questions. The first is really a clarification of what Maggie said, and that was an intimation that there are sanctions, that their sanctions start with or perhaps almost end with suspension and possible termination. And the reason I'm asking for clarification is it's not clear that in the RAA such a sanction as suspension for inaccurate who is data is possible. The second question, I'm really interested in your complaints because I'm not sure what your actual process is for handling complaints. How would people know to complain directly to you, or do they? So where does where do the complaints come from? Is this complaints made to registrars that you're gathering, or is it complaints made directly to ICANN?
So, Holly, if I may take your first question. And Matt, slide 14, please. Complaints come to us in different ways. Usually, today, we have three systems that people are familiar with. We refer to them as the C ticket. We have the W ticket and the UDRP. And they each serve different purpose. Then we also receive emails or phone calls. So that's why we call them intake, because this is the current state. And if you, again, it wasn't a question asked of us, so we're trying to just bring to this forum, but we have short, mid, and long-term plans on consolidating the complaint system, so we have one tool, one mean. Now, regarding the suspension process, the suspension process relates to a breach notice, and I'd like to turn it to Pam to address it in a little bit more details.
Sure. So, Holly, if I understand you correctly, you are asking whether who is in inaccuracy, if a registrar is not complying with the who is obligation, would that amount to a suspension as a penalty? As you can see in this chart, our non-compliance follow-up process is the same for who is in inaccuracy. So those tickets usually will come through the who is data problem reporting system. We call it W ticket here, you can see. And they will be followed through the three prevention steps here, first notice, second notice, and third notice. If the registrar failed to become compliant, you know, in terms of who is inaccuracy claim, every registrar is required to take reasonable steps to investigate the reported claim. So their obligation is just that, to take reasonable steps to investigate. So if by third step they still fail to demonstrate that, then a notice of breach will follow. And then suspension. So it is not just because it is a who is inaccuracy that we would depart from this process. Does that answer your question?
If the problem is not the inaccuracy, it's that has the registrar taken reasonable steps, and that's the question you ask, and if they fail to, then there is suspension is the way it works under the RAA right now.
Yes, so that's the process. Holly, at the moment we are reviewing the current WHO's inaccuracy follow-up process. The current process and the cycle we feel is too long. So we are in the process of shortening that follow-up process, and also a very important step we are trying to change is in our first notice to registrar concerned, we will be asking for proof. We are not waiting for the third step. They're not talking to us, not telling us what to do. And we are making reference to the contract, the RAA. There's a RAA 342, I believe, the registrar data retention obligation. And 343 will be providing such data to ICANN upon request. We're making express reference in the first notice of inquiry to registrar. If the registrar then doesn't come back with proof, it will be a breach of those provisions as well as who is inaccuracy likely. So we want to make it sort of stronger, tighter, to tighten up the process to make sure we have a more effective follow-up process.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have a queue in operation since there are so many questions. And yes, Shiva, you will be in the queue. It starts with Evan, then Garth, Cheryl, Shiva, and Bo. So Evan first, please.
Hi there. This is Evan Leibovich. I've got a math question, a clarity question, and a transparency question. The math question first is on slide 10, and there's some numbers there, and I'm curious to know how 1 plus 15 adds up to 205.
Can I jump in and answer that?
Yes, go ahead, Khalil.
There seems to be a bit of an echo. Well, the 16 are complaints actually received through a particular application we have for registrars who did not implement UDRP decisions. That's a very specific thing. Now, we also have another general complaint system where a complainant can launch a complaint about almost anything, and we received 200-plus complaints concerning UDRP or that were categorized by the complainant as UDRP. Now, most of those, in fact, probably 95% of those were actually non-compliance issues, and so that's why they don't appear as the 16 in a chart. But with respect to registrars' obligations under the UDRP, we have that application because that's a specific registrar obligation of the contract, and we monitor that more closely, even though we receive complaints about general things in other systems. Does that clarify?
Okay, and it actually leads me into the clarity question, which goes on to page 10, slide 10. Slide 6. And I have a question about the noting of 24% being invalid. That bothers me because it doesn't tell me what it's about. Is it irrelevant to compliance? Was it rejected on technicalities? Was the form not filled out right? 24% is an awfully high amount of complaints to be rejected, and I'd like to have a little bit more clarity on what that means about being invalid. Is it out of scope, or like what are the reasons under which something is rejected as invalid?
So there could be several reasons. One is when you actually file an inaccuracy complaint, the complainant is required to confirm that complaint within a specific amount of time. When that does not happen, those complaints are rejected. Also, under the RAA, there are certain categories of which the registrar must make data available to the public. It's 3.3.1. And sometimes the alleged inaccurate information is not required to be provided by the registrar under the RAA. Also, there are categories of complaints related to WHO's inaccuracy, which actually don't relate to WHO's inaccuracy, but relate to website content, spamming, and other things which are not technically WHO's inaccuracy complaints under the contract. Our compliance program is based on the contract, which is why it's called the Contractual Compliance Program, so everything we do has to relate back to the contract. And when it doesn't, particularly with respect to WHO's obligations, it's rejected.
Okay, I'm going to make a suggestion that you break this down a little better because it is an important thing for the community to know if there are complaints that may be valid to the community but are outside the exact scope of what you're doing. That's something that ICANN needs to tackle. Maybe it's not within your scope to tackle, but ICANN still needs to address it somehow. And if this is something falling through the cracks, we need to know about it.
We appreciate the feedback, and one of the things that we've done later in this slide deck is offered an email address where people who also have additional feedback in addition to what you provided can actually send us their thoughts about how we can do things better, or maybe we're doing a great job, et cetera. So please, if they can, before this ends, if that email address can be referred to again, that'd be good. Thank you for your suggestions.
And my last thing has to do with that chart on 16 that has the various stages of compliance. And, that one. I'm hoping that you might actually formalize this and saying something is in stage 1, stage 2, stage 3, stage 4, stage 5, and so on, so that when you show us those other yellow, those other charts that have the yellow boxes on them, where you're not disclosing to us where the problem is, you're also telling us where along are they on first notice, are they on second notice, are they on third notice. And it's not just enough to say, okay, we can't tell you anything. At least also tell us how far along you are with each of these. Or have you just discovered it? Have you been around the block with them for 5 years? These are also important things to know. Where in the process is it? And since you've laid this out very well in terms of the procedure and the progress, it's important, I think, also for the community to know that if there's a complaint and if you're actively going, if you're going to block stuff out with yellow boxes, there's also an obligation to try and be as clear to us as possible about this. And the last thing is just to echo what Bo was saying, that, considering the affirmation of commitments, ICANN to me has a responsibility to err on the side of transparency, and frankly, I don't know why you have to wait until breach to publish names. There's a valuable consumer benefit to being able to say somebody has received a lot of complaints. They're not yet in breach, but it is not a matter of opinion. It is a matter of actual fact that a registrar has received complaints, and I don't know why ICANN believes that it is in the public interest to withhold that. Instead of having yellow blocks on data.
Okay. Yep. So actually we do track, which process step we are in terms of each complaint and follow-up ticket. The thinking for us is this. We consider this a self-regulatory model, like everyone in this room would recognize that. We feel it is important for registrars to work with us, or for us to work with registrars and give them an opportunity to fix the problems. And in the past, as I just mentioned, we are revising the WHOIS data inaccuracy follow-up process. But we have, in many cases where we don't have communication from the registrar or the complaint against party, we just have the complaint from whoever alleging there's wrongdoing or whatever. So just for procedural fairness, you need to allow the other party to come back to us, tell us their side of the story. Sometimes we don't have that opportunity yet. That's why we are revising our process to say, you might be in breach of IRTP or in breach of WHOIS, but we also want you to provide data under the contract. So now we have better clarity. If they don't even communicate to us, that itself is a breach. So we are trying to tighten up the process. It's in the spirit of collaboration we feel it is appropriate that we do not disclose the registrar ID or identity or registry identity during the preventative informal resolution process. If the community feels that there's a need, we have to sort of talk about how to address that. There is sensitivity and also consideration about collaboration and the best outcome for all of us.
Just a suggestion, even the idea of publishing during phase 3 can be a powerful tool before you engage in breach. Disclosure tends to be a very powerful incentive for people to clean up before you have to go as far as a breach. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I think that with regards to the second point that Evan was making, if there is a part of the mission of compliance that needs to be done, that the community feels needs to be done, it might be something that compliance is not mandated with. And if the mandate needs to be changed, then the community might wish to write a statement to ask for that mandate to be changed. But we'll cross that bridge when we have to. Okay, we have a very long list. In fact, I think I'll stop the line here because I see that we've had three people so far ask questions, and we spent 45 minutes already. We've got Garth, Cheryl, Shivash, Bo, and Alan. So, Garth. Sorry, Holly, you've already had your 10 minutes of fame.
Thank you, Olivier. So far, I like the direction of this. I'd like to see more staff and more process in this area. I just have two questions, and I'll ask the first question, wait for the answer, and then ask a second question. And this is Garth Bruin, if I didn't say that before. I have a letter from ICANN Compliance to me from December 2010, and in part this letter says that ICANN will check the websites of registrars before crediting them under the 2009 contract, and as part of its regular audit schedule, will check the websites for compliance. Last night, I found 10 registrars, all accredited recently, who do not have terms, who is, address, or other contact information on the website. And my question is this process actually in effect? And how do these registrars keep getting accredited without having a compliant website? And then I'll wait for the second question.
So I'll jump in. Well, two things. The ICANN compliance team does not accredit registrars. It's a different team within ICANN, so I'm not comfortable as the other teams may not be speaking to that. With respect to the registrars who are failing to provide a website under the 2009 RAA, part of what we do is collaboration, and we receive complaints from community members, and that's usually how we take action because sometimes you see things that we don't. So I would encourage you to forward that information to us because I think, as you've seen even recently, we do actually take steps when you send us things.
Okay, thank you. I will, of course, send these to you. But just as in reference to the letter, this is, falls under the proactive area. It seems that it was a proactive program. Anyway, my second question is clarifying Holly's question because it is probably the most important question that's going to be asked maybe at this conference. And I'm going to phrase it very, very clearly. In reference to 378 of the RRA, is it a breach of the registrar's contract to fail to delete a domain with false who is? And I'm asking this question in the context irrespective of their process for their process for actually conducting an investigation. A simple yes or no would be fine.
So although I'd like to give you a yes or no, it's not possible for me to engage in a compliance analysis in this particular forum, and I'd have to see the specific case, or we'd have to see the specific case to know. As you know, there's been at least two advisories that ICANN issued on 3.7.8, which is the registrar obligation to investigate inaccuracies, and I would encourage everyone to go and read those closely because it provides a great deal of data on this. So unfortunately, it's not possible to answer that question.
The advisory, I've read it thoroughly, and it seems to indicate that deletion is completely at the discretion of the registrar and therefore not a requirement or something that can be issued a breach notice for. And more clarification on that specific question would be appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We'll go down our queue, hopefully. Shorter questions, shorter answers. Cheryl.
Please. Cheryl Langdonor for the transcript record, and I can't predict the answer, but I can assure you the question is short. To the all popular slide 14, which is still on the screen, going to the red suspension box, and believe me, I'm a perfect fan of suspension, and anyone who looks at the .au CCTLD will know we have a fairly proactive and public and transparent mechanism for dealing with issues in our CCTLD. Can I ask, however, as suspension in my knowledge of what's happened before is a relative new thing, what is happening in terms of consumer protection, the registrants who are with the suspended entity during that suspension period? Are names locked? How much risk are we exposing ourselves to with what I think is a very good model, but I'm just a little worried that I might be able to drive a truck through something?
Thank you. Great question, Cheryl. Just before the suspension, or soon after the suspension notice was issued, we also published a FAQ for the general public about registrar suspension. Explain what it is about, why registrar suspended, how they will be affected as a consumer. The suspension only prohibits two things. One is the registrar cannot add new names, registered create new names. The other thing is they cannot initiate inbound transfers. So all other registrar services or activities will be business as usual, okay? So existing registrants can still transfer their name out, renew their names, and apart from those two activities I described above, okay? So it's effectively really probably new customers are likely to be affected. We also require the registrar suspended to publish on their website that they cannot accept any new names on their website. So basically kind of alert to whoever visit their website, hey, we're under suspension. You may want to think twice about registering them with us. So we are taking measures to make sure we inform the public, and the registrar also has that publication on their website, notice on their website. If you consider there are other measures that we haven't considered or should consider, please come up with suggestions or recommendations, and we'll duly consider them carefully.
Sherilyn, and off the transcript record, I think this might be something that the community would like to engage in a conversation amongst ourselves and then get back to you on, but just off the top of my head, the concern that in that 30 days, once it's public that the suspension is on and for all the right reasons, a registrant wants to move away from the suspended party. There is nothing in what I can see that would stop the suspended party making that transfer extremely difficult. So I think we might need to just be very careful that things can't, for example, be moved to a sister organisation. There's all sorts of clever things that bad actors may be able to do, and we might need to have that as a discussion specifically on topic at a future meeting.
Thank you, Cheryl. Next is, now we still have three people. I don't know if we can do that. We've got 5 minutes left, so very short question and very short answers as well, please, Pam. Shiva first. Then Bo, and then Alan. Shiva.
Shiva Subramanian, for the record. And the number of complaints issues that comes to know, is it a true indication of the total magnitude of complaints from customers and total magnitude of consumer issues? Is there any way by which ICANN could make it possible for a consumer to be directly in touch with ICANN, either by integrating API, a contact API in the registrar's website, so that the consumer could directly file a complaint with ICANN in cases where his problems are not solved by the registrar? And the other thing is, you were talking about in case of suspension, making it an obligation for the registrars to display a notice on their websites. But most registrations are done not by the registrar, but by the reseller. So are you also making it mandatory for the reseller under that particular registrar to display that their domain name will be registered by a suspended registrar?
No, ICANN doesn't have a contract with the resellers. So we cannot mandate the resellers to do X, Y, Z.
No, but you could mandate the registrar to say that any domain name registered under the registrar, either through the reseller or direct, comes under the purview of that RAA.
Sure, but a lot of resellers are actually working with a number of registrars, so they might be working with one that's suspended, but others they're not suspended, so it's kind of a complex ecology there. So at the moment, we are not doing that in the reseller space.
Okay, two more questions, one from Bo and one from Alan, and then you can go. And we'll make it very quick, please.
I'll make it as fast as I can. I just in general, I wanted to say that I while I see some strides being made here, I think that this presentation is unsatisfactory. The answer is evasive and clearly outside the spirit of the affirmation of commitments. My question is the registrar advisory concerning who is data accuracy. That seems to be referred to a fair amount. We are referring to the document that's 10 years old. Is that correct? Are there plans in the works to take a look at this particular document and perhaps update it?
So there are two registrar advisories. One is issued in 2002 and one is 2003. I'm not aware currently of plans to update those documents, but I am aware of who is review team and other efforts within ICANN to address the who is ecology in total scope. So no, there are no, I'm not aware anyway.
Thank you, Khalil. Last question, Alan.
Thank you. They're not actually questions. 2 points. One is a pet peeve of mine, which came up when I was working on the PEDNR PDP, and I've suggested it numerous times. I'm sure there are good technical reasons why you can't do it, and I'm sure there's a time lag, but I'll say it again anyway. On your complaint form, you have a long laundry list of complaints. The software, the web form, only lets you select one. That skews your statistics badly because the person submitting the form may not pick the one that you think it fits under, and if they have multiple complaints or they can't characterize it well, they may pick the wrong one. Your results are skewed, and therefore the decisions you take based on them are skewed. Figure out how to fix it. I don't know if it's simple or not, but figure out, please. That's one. I have another one, but I'll let Maggie answer if she wants to.
I'm not going to say we're working on it, but I do have the details of the short-term, long-term, and the future plans for our systems, and that is one of my pet peeves, too.
I'll continue saying it every meeting until I see it fixed, though.
Okay, so we'll bring you updates at the next meeting where we are on that process.
And, of course, there are ways to answer, to ask more questions or more comments sent over to compliance, but Evan has a way to do this.
I just want to add one more that I didn't have on my list until Pam answered a previous question.
Can you email
Please,
us?
Never, ever glibly say we don't have a contract with resellers when there are often, I understand your issue with multiple registrars for reseller and all those issues, but you don't have contracts with resellers, you have contracts with registrars, and you can put in those contracts that they must do things. So that answer just turns the hair up on some of our backs. Thank you. Occasionally it's even valid,
so
I understand.
We'll organize how the questions will be taken. I just want to close so that we can let Maggie and Pam go. Just one last quick thing. Using the usual Father Christmas story, I'm Father Christmas, and my domain name was stolen from me because of various reasons and so on. I go over to the compliance page, and I find out things which mean absolutely nothing to me. I'm an old person having to distribute presents to kids once a year, and when I read things like, if you have a problem with one of the ICANN accredited registrars, you should first try to resolve it with that registrar using the list of all accredited registrars, and the list is darn long. If you cannot resolve your complaint with a registrar, you could address it to private sector agencies involved in addressing customer complaints or governmental consumer protection agencies, or you can click here for more information about ICANN's complaints options, and you see a huge list of things which mean absolutely nothing to me. This needs to be changed.
Okay.
Thank you.
That noted, it's better than before.
My last question is an omnibus that will take care of other things. If we as a group collect a series of points and questions of things that have been unasked, because there is a still long list of things yet unasked, will you commit to us here to respond to them in a timely manner in a way that can be redistributed to the community? Because there is a long list. We can't take care of it now, but we can put it in writing to you.
I think we've had that discussion before in Singapore. In Dakar, you sent it to me 2 days in advance. The wiki's been open for weeks. We received 3 questions and 177 from Garth. So I think I'm challenging the audience. If I have not responded to your questions, that means I have not received it. My pet peeve is same as Alan's and same as yours. We still have to work on the content. please send us your questions. But please, no complaining. Complaining window is 8 a.m. to 8:05 a.m. We want feedback with facts so we can measure what we're doing. Put yourselves in our shoes. I don't want sympathy. I love what I do. I'm passionate where I am. But please, give us specifics so we can work on. Garf gave me specifics now. I'm not committing to answering every letter Garf sends me with all the bulk complaints because our system cannot handle that today. But I've taken that as a feedback for the new tool so we can keep the complainant up to speed on where we are. So to answer you, send me your question with facts, please, so we can get to you with an answer. Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to be with you. I know it's hard to please everyone. I'm not here to please. It's not a competition of pleasing. It's a competition of ICANN community. And I really welcome your feedback. I'm passionate, like I said, but just help us get better. Help us serve this community. We're on the same team. Thank you again, and good luck for the rest of the week.
Fam, Khalil, Maggie, thanks very much. And so the wiki page will remain open, but what Evan has just suggested is that we might have a shepherd that will remind people on filling this. How would you envisage this, Evan?
Well, as of right now, everybody's got questions that are fresh in your mind right now, having seen the slideshow, having seen some of the discussion. While you have these questions fresh in your mind, we need a way to collect these, to summarize these, and to be able to submit them in writing after the fact so they get dealt with. So rather than waiting and say, go for the wiki or whatever, I'm suggesting right now in real time, while you are thinking about it this moment, collect your thoughts and questions and send them to what?
Matt will help you on this.
If my mailbox is the answer to that, that's fine. I just think it's something.
Hi, this is Matt Ashjani for the record. There's actually a page already up right now where members were supposed to have posted their questions in advance. Rather than use that, we can use it right now for members to post their thoughts and their questions right now. And then for the next meeting, we already have it written down, and I can hyperlink, and it's already done.
Okay, so picking up on what Matt said, please, if you've got things right now that are fresh in your mind, having just heard this discussion, we've still got the slides up here. If you want to make reference to them, put them on the wiki, and I'll commit to assembling them and getting them off to Maggie.
Okay, so we're now running late, which is quite customary. We have to move on to the next thing on our agenda, and that's the at-large event roadmap with a quick discussion and next steps. Could I ask, Matt, do you have this in the machine? Could you put this on the screen, please?
There are only three people in this conference.
Great.
This call will be disconnected unless you press 88 now. Thank you. This conference will continue.
I'm pressing 88.
Fantastic. And I wonder if this is going to be transcribed one way or other. Okay, so whilst the page loads, just a quick background on this. I refer everyone, of course, to the events roadmap being the roadmap that was put together in order to somehow show how we were going to organize ourselves in the next few years and basically provide a forecast to ICANN finance as to what our future needs are going to be. Because it seems that every year we go to them and show them what we require, whether we're speaking about capacity building or general assemblies or other things, such as the summits, like the Mexico one, they look and say, oh, but we don't know how to forecast these things. So we've basically put together a roadmap. And if we can scroll down, do I have control of this? Oh, I might do. So I'm not sure if all of you have seen this this roadmap. I know that members of the Finance and Budget Subcommittee have. And it basically looks at the next 4 years, 5 years, and as a years as in fiscal years. And you have to remember, a fiscal year is it from August to August, or is it July to July? thank you, Tijani. It's from July to July, and you then see the forecast of when we would be requiring, or we would be asking, rather, for funding for general assemblies, and looking at the different cycle of the regions and where the ICANN meetings are, bearing in mind that it has been agreed that it would be best to conduct general assemblies in the ICANN meeting taking place in that region. So I realize that looking at the screen, it is very small for people to see. I do hope that you've got the link, that you've clicked on the link and you've been able to look at this. The forecast is that we would be having General Assembly. Let's see, so there was Africa, so the next one, well, there's been one asked for in for North America. There is also one which is asked for Europe, I believe. Anyway, the roadmap itself is a document which has been put together to discuss the future with ICANN Finance. So I don't know if anyone wishes to discuss this in detail or if there is any worth looking at specific points on there. I know that Tijani had a few suggestions on this. Of course, we're basically just putting on an Excel work document, the discussions which we had in the past of having a general assembly, is it once every two times in a region? So each region would basically get a general assembly, a face-to-face general assembly, once every 5 years. And there would also be a summit once every 7 years. And that was something which was discussed a very long time ago on this. It was just a way to map this on the roadmap. The floor is open for discussion. It looks as though there are less volunteers to discuss this than for the compliance part, which is always a very successful session and very close to heart with people. I see Tijani wishes to come in. Go ahead, Tijani.
Thank you, Olivier. The projection that Olivier told about now seems to be really feasible. But if you make the count, you will have in 7 years one General Assembly per region plus one summit. That means two summits. Since one General Assembly per region, it's one summit in terms of the cost. So we may think about a periodic summit of 3 or 4 years. It is less complicated to implement, but as Olivier said, perhaps they will not accept this kind of proposal because it will they will look at it as very costly. Each operation is very costly. So if you give them only General Assembly per year, it will not be as costly as one summit each 3 or 4 years. So it is another way to look at it. But I think that both are feasible, but the most simple is to work with summits, periodic summits, for a period of 4 years, for example.
Thank you, Tijani. Any thoughts about this? Sergio?
Thank you, Olivier. Sergio Salinas Porto for the records. I was thinking about Tijani's proposal. I think it is important to make a sustainable proposal and within each region, and this 3 to 4 year period is okay, because if not, we would have a 7 year span in between, and many of us would not be able to participate. I look at myself in 7 years, and probably I may be working on these processes, but maybe a colleague of mine is going to take my place, and I would like to see all of you more often. So I believe that this three-year span is important, and it is also important for us to propose something to ICANN that is feasible for them, that ICANN finds doable. Otherwise, we always put them between a rock and a hard place, and on the other hand, we will be aggravated because we also have the right, and they also believe they have their own rights. So I think that this 3 to 4 year period for a summit is feasible, and it's an opportunity for us to meet face to face and get together to have all the relays and have this common synergy, and that is really important. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Sergio. Next, I see Alan having put his hand up. Alan.
If you go back in history long enough, and some of us, unfortunately, have been gone through the history, the concept that we came up with several years ago was we would try to do five assemblies in 3 years, and then the following 3 years we would have no assemblies but have a summit somewhere in that period, perhaps picking it to minimize the travel costs, which, of course, are significantly higher than regional assemblies because 4/5 of the people come from some other region. That was a nice plan, except up until this year, or maybe not yet, we were so unsuccessful in getting money even for regional assemblies on a predictable basis that it was hard to try to set in long-range plans. We're still not at the position, until we see the results of this coming budget year, to know whether we're anywhere close to having five regional assemblies in 3 years. At the current rate, it looks like the best we'll do is five regional assemblies in 5 years, unless we have been successful in our application. So I think first we have to establish the regular annual funding at a reasonable level that is enough for, 1 2/3 assemblies per year on the average. And then we're in a position to say, let's bank the money, which ICANN tells us they're going to develop the principles for, to do it, you know, to do the summits. Otherwise, if we try to do a summit now, right now, I think we're going to have to put all of our eggs in one basket getting that approval will almost cut off our money for an untold number of years afterwards, and I think we have to be careful we don't do that.
Thank you, Alan. So I hear somehow it will take time for the cultural shift to take place. Sala.
Salnieta Tamaniko Emero for the record. Just a few comments in terms of future planning and that sort of thing. I have a suggestion. If in terms of the RALO summit, if it would possible, in terms of future planning, to coordinate with the regional, whether it's the regional NOGs or the regional IGFs or regional ISOC meetings or something like that, to have things back-to-back, only in terms of convenience, shared costs, everyone's converging, and at the end of the day, we'll all benefit, and it's also outreach as well from an at-large perspective.
Thank you, Sala. It's a very laudable suggestion. Such suggestions have been made in the past. If you wish to have even less chance of having assemblies taking place, that's the path to take, I'm afraid, because it's been frowned upon for some reason by ICANN, and it's a bit of a religious thing rather than anything else. And by religious, of course, there are things which are unexplainable, and this one is totally unexplainable, but there you are. The world is sometimes unfortunate. Sandra.
It's Sandra Hofrichter for the transcript record. It's really a pity to hear that, Olivier, that there are religion constructions about this, because in Europe we are quite successful combining a general assembly with a European dialogue on internet governance. And it could be, as Sala mentioned, really, really cost-saving. And it's a great outreach tool. And Wolfmai is not. I thought he's going to to agree with me. It could be a thing to develop, and maybe we should try to go on with this effort and to overcome the hurdles.
Thank you, Sandra. Wolf, and then Sala.
Direct comment. Maybe most of you realize that I hate to contradict Sandra, but in this case I have to do because there are two aspects involved. Juridic, as Sandra rightly said, is a perfect outreach opportunity for Juralo. And it has strengthened Juralo, the credibility, reputation of Juralo considerably, because Juralo was one of the founding members of the success story of Juridic. But it was a necessity that we used the Juridic as an opportunity. According to our bylaws, we are forced to organize one general assembly per year. And we hadn't had any support from the ICANN side since 2009, we used once the IGF in Europe, in Vilnius, in 2010. And last year we used the Juridic in Belgrade. And this year we will use Juridic in Stockholm for our General Assembly. But only a small portion of members can afford. So this is not a real face-to-face meeting. And sorry to say or to insist, but it leaves ICANN a little bit out of its responsibility. And as we do not, as we couldn't convince Microsoft or any major Soros, major donor in the world to give us 20,000 bucks. So it's on a volunteers level for only few people among our ALSs who can afford. And I would wish that next year, at least 2013, we might have a chance to organize our first face-to-face General Assembly 4 years later after Mexico. And I can tell you the motivation among our members decreased considerably. There is a lot of frustration in the community, and it's one thing to attract new members, but the most challenging thing for Juralo at the moment is keep the old members active and involved. Thanks.
Thank you. Wolf, I think you're preaching to the converted. We all agree, but others don't quite see the light. Thanks for repeating it. It's good to put it on the record. Sala, and then we'll have Tejani, and then Fatima. But first, Sala.
Salaniyata Tamaniko Emoro. We had this discussion within RALO, within AP RALO, and we acknowledged that for this particular budget, I mean, that was... you know, it's technically, well, it's impossible, but I was making the comment in terms of future preparations and that sort of thing. Having said that, one of the things we discussed within AP RALO was that we would want to host it alongside our Asian Pacific Regional IGF. And I'm happy also to report that there's very good support from various various people from the private sector and that sort of thing. Even in terms of the Pacific, and I'd just like to welcome Maureen, who's sitting at the back there from Cook Islands, who's the chair of PICAISOC, an ALS within AP RALO. She's traveled a really long way to get here. And the good news is, even within the Pacific, we're planning a meeting, and this is actually initiated, believe it or not, by the CCNSO, by some of our members from the CCNSO within our region, who are supporting capacity development And that's scheduled to happen sometime in May. And so the at-large community, well, the reps from AP Ralu who live within the region will gather and converge. And we're looking at 22 countries and territories within the Pacific. And whilst at the moment there's technically one ALS, we're hoping to develop a capacity. Yes. And so with that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Sala. Next is Tijani.
Thank you. Tijani speaking. The disadvantage of holding General Assemblies outside ICANN meetings, besides those enumerated by Wolf and the others, there is also the fact that we will not make use of the facilities of ICANN meetings, such as interpretation, and other. Another thing we need to think about is it is a pity that during a general, when we do a General Assembly, people will not have the opportunity to attend the ICANN meeting at the same time. Thank you.
Thank you, Tijani. Next on the list is Fatima Cambronero.
Spanish. I'm
going to be brief because everybody, they said what I meant. Last year when the EGF was organized in the Caribbean region, we requested ICANN fund for an outreach event together with a pre-IGF, and we couldn't get the funds from certain members of Lac Ralu. For this year, we are planning as a plan B, to put it somehow, to celebrate our Lac Ralu GA together with the regional IGF that we didn't know which venue would have. But I don't know the reasons for this. Somehow it seems to be a resistance in joining us or in joining ICANN and the organizers of the IGF. And I don't understand why, because we are all the same people working and participating for the same purposes. So perhaps we might be able to articulate all this so that we come out with certain results. That's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Fatima. And perhaps that would be, as an action item, a question that the XCOM could ask the high authorities that come and visit it on the Friday afternoon after the meeting, because it is a question which I haven't had any answer for, and goodness knows how many times we've asked it from various people in ICANN, and maybe it's time to ask it again. Why? Why can we not do outreach the way outreach should be done? So do you wish to... So the action item is to ask whoever will come and visit us on Friday afternoon, everyone who will come and visit us, why is outreach not possible, or funded outreach not possible in places outside of ICANN? And I guess outreach can only be done anyway outside of ICANN. So the question doesn't make sense, but I'm sure you can design a question that will fit in this way. Do you wish to add something? Go ahead, Tijani.
I don't agree with this action item, because we don't need... it is not preferable to make General Assemblies outside of the ICANN meetings.
Tijani, it doesn't relate only to a General Assembly. It relates to the actual funding of anything that takes place outside of ICANN walls that we could use for outreach. And I think that you do agree with this, since you have made requests in the past several times and have ended up paying with your own pockets, sir. Okay, so now that this is clear, I think we can move to the next part of our agenda, and we're only slightly 15 minutes late. It's Carlton who's going to be able to provide us with a quick feedback on the Who Is process. I didn't even use the right name for this.
Who is at large perspective on who is?
At large perspective on who is. So, Carlton, you have the floor.
Thank you, Chair. Colleagues, you will recall that in speaking to Who Is this morning and asking for your attention to the draft statement on the UHU's review team report. I mentioned that there are several aspects to is that we have been tracking in our own interests. There is the issue of the WHOIS data set itself, which is to say, what are the pieces of data that the WHOIS that is required of the registrars to collect for WHOIS compliance. And secondly, there is the issue of access to that data. And the third is, of course, the entire business of how, the nexus of access and compliance of data, which is to say the privacy and the proxy issues. I have been looking at this deeply since about 2008, but my colleague, Alan Greenberg, has been at it probably longer than anybody else. And Alan is our liaison to the GNSO. The GNSO, as you know, sees itself as being the predominant player in policy development in the ICANN world. And as GNSO liaison, they have been looking at some of the WHOIS issues, and which tends to form part of our perspective. I have asked Alan to speak to you on the issue of the at-large perspective to the WHOIS, particularly in terms of what is happening in the GNSO side. Alan, you have the floor, sir.
Just a correction, you say the GNSO sees itself as the predominant player. The GNSO is the player, according to ICANN bylaws, of establishing GTLD policy. So that's not subject to debate. I should point out that is not, despite what some people in the GNSO Council think, that is not the only thing the GNSO can do, but it has sole domain over that, because to establish policy, there are certain implications of under what conditions the board can approve something or not approve something, and so policy issues do have to go through the GNSO. There's no GTLD policy issues. Now, on WHOIS, there is a long history of not being able to come to closure. You know, there was a PDP a bunch of years ago which failed abysmally, to be blunt. There are a whole bunch of other efforts going on. Some of them are going on because various players in the game felt that there was no way to come to closure eventually without, for instance, having hard data. So there are a number of studies going on. It's some initiated by the GNSO. The GAC itself made a request for a whole long list of studies which were incorporated into that list. The studies that the GNSO is involved in right now or has sponsored, we're talking about $500,000 worth of study work. So it's not inconsequential. The WHOIS review team has also done a study of its own, of course, independently. One of the issues that comes out is an intriguing one, and it's actually something that was going to be discussed at the GNSO board meeting that I had to walk out of to be here. So I don't quite know how I don't think it was finished, but I don't know how it went, is the affirmation of commitment says that there shall be review teams and the board must implement the results within a year or something like that. That's fine on the transparency one, because that's wholly within the board's domain. On WHOIS, under our bylaws, the board cannot unilaterally take action on some of those issues. So it's not clear how the review team's results are going to get implemented in some cases. And there's a lot of process we need to think about. The AOC, I don't believe, was written in
full cognizance of what our bylaws say for how we do things. All of that says, does Mikey want to speak or is he just waving? Okay. All of that says things are, there's a lot of things going on right now in parallel. One would like to think that in a year or so from now, it will all have coalesced into a nice, simple pattern which will result in good stuff. I'm not quite sure I or anyone else understands exactly how we're going to get from here to there. I also know that very few of us have a stomach for having this continue for the rest of our lives. So somehow we're going to have to fix this, and there are enough external influences. The fact that there was a Who Is review team included in the AOC gives you some indication of the belief from the outside world that this is a problem which ICANN better fix if ICANN is going to continue to survive and either pretend or actually be in control of the things that it has scope over. I'm not sure I can say anything clearer than that. The whole situation is about as clear as a very muddy river right now. It will hopefully get better. There's a lot going on. I sent to the, I think to the at-large list and the ALAC list the other day, a list of GNSO projects, which lists some of them. You're clearly aware of the Who Is review team. And all you have to do is go to the ICANN homepage or listen to our compliance discussion from our previous session and know that Who Is accuracy is not something which is going to be ignored. Heaven knows whether we'll fix it properly, but it's not going to be ignored. So does that give you the summary you wanted? I'm not sure there's a lot of clarity there. And if you're confused, that means you're starting to understand.
I was about to tell you that that's exactly what it is, because it's confusing everywhere. But there are two things that come out of this. The Who Is review team is proposing that what we should have first and foremost is a comprehensive Who Is policy. And when they say policy, it means it goes through the GNSO ringer to come out a policy on the other side. There's a whole set of issues that they feel that could be addressed within the RAA itself, a contract. And there are some that they feel that will require PDPs to be developed. We tell you this because the complexity of the Who Is issue and where it breaks down, along whether or not it is policy, whether along it's a contractual situation, is still in play, and there is no general agreement. And even where those two things kind of begin and end. So the at large, in defining an at large perspective on it, there are a couple of things that I think we in at large have come to agree on, and I'll talk about them when I go back to Alan.
I have a question for Mikey first. The current UDRP sets of PDPs, when did that start? My recollection is it's close to 2004 or 5, that the process started, which is triggering, as we speak, new PDPs. The initial review of UDRP.
This is Mikey O'Connor from the...
Not UDRP, sorry.
IRTP.
IRTP.
I figured that's what you were talking about. I think it started in 2006 or 2007.
Okay. It was. I started in 2006, and it was already on the way. So it was at least 2006. The point I'm making is these things take a long time. On IRTP, we had the wisdom. I would say we because I really wasn't part of the decision to break things up into multiple pieces. And I think we're going to see the same in who is. I was part of a discussion just before I came into this meeting on another issue related to policy. And Bruce Tonkin, who used to chair the GNSO before he went onto the board, pointed out that a policy can be simple or a policy can be detailed. In IRTP, the policy can say, registrants should have the right to transfer domains. That's it. We now have a policy. Or it can be in excruciating detail, and it takes a long time to work out the detail. I suspect what we're going to find in WHO is we're going to come out with a policy that's simple and then start working on the details, and hopefully not in a single piece, because we'd never finish that. So that's how I see it coming out. Whether that's the way the world will unfold, I don't know. But, you know, just like IRTP, which is a subset of a subset of things, has taken a huge amount of effort to try to get right and fix the problems that we see, I don't think WHOIS is going to disappear overnight. But we need a road plan, a route map of how to get there. And that's what I'm optimistic will come out of this current process.
Thank you. Let me say that is a good segue in what I wanted to say, because I believe that if you look at a policy perspective and from the ALAC perspective, the simple policy statement that I believe we should support is to say that the objective of the WHO is still remains, and we should have it. That's the first statement. If you look at what the objective was it was simply this. Registrars are supposed to collect certain pieces of information from registrants. And that information, once collected, must be kept in a specific place, and it must be available freely. That's what it says, period. If you're going to articulate policy along WHOIS, and given the whole conundrum of about a data set and the access and all of these things, then if you start with a simple policy and then allow over time to develop the more detailed set connected to that, I think it would be a reasonable and rational way to go about it, and I suspect that that would be what the ALAC would wish to support in terms of policy. Fatima, you wanted to say something. You have the floor.
Thank you, Carton. A question. It is something that I am not understanding. The WHOIS review team, when they carried out their functions, they determined that throughout all their documentations that were revised, they didn't have a policy related to WHOIS on the part of ICANN. So what I don't understand is at-large position, if it is there is a position, or do you recommend a PDP for WHOIS, or how are you going to manage this issue? What is ALAC's position about this issue? Thank you very much.
Agrees with the review team perspective that there should be a defined ICANN policy on WHOIS. We're making it one step further here. I'm saying is that our approach to defining that policy is, let us recommend starting with a simple one and then move through that. So the simple policy statement that says WHOIS is required, period, and then we move through it. Alan is on next online. You want to say something?
Yeah. I think we have to be careful with the pronouncement from the review team that there is no policy. What they're saying is there is no centrally located, easily findable policy all in a single place. There's lots of policy. Some of it is in the form of terms of contracts, which de facto become policy, because they have to be followed by the contract, by the various contractors. There is various pieces of consensus policy that has been written, but it's not all unified in a simple place where we can say, who is policy? So it's a little bit of a confusing statement in that we have plenty of who is policy. It's just not all easily located and findable. And some of it is not well defined. There's no doubt about that part. So I think part of it is going to be to gather together the various documents and put it in a central repository organized in some reasonable way so we can at least understand what we do have and what we don't have. We shouldn't get too carried away by saying we don't have a who is policy. We have many who is policies, many bits of who is policies.
What I read them to mean is that it is like you said, there is no single overarching document that says here is the perspective that we are defending and we are pushing forward. That's what they really mean. As I pointed out, we are happy with, if you look at the statement that we wrote, we are happy with the fact that the contract, who is right now, is most of it is contractually obliged, and we're happy with that because, as far as we're concerned, the contracts themselves ought to be within the purview of the entire community agreeing on what those should be. So that's how we backed into that. We said, fine. We see them, OIS is in contracts right now in the RAA. Most of the elements that we would be concerned with are subject to RAA compliance. But we ourselves don't necessarily believe that there's no policy. All we're saying is that if we agree that the contracts themselves ought to come from this consensus policy position that is ICANN, then it's fine. Holly, can I ask Holly first?
Can I first add? I think we've got to be careful in stopping equating who is with just the GNSO, because there's a whole big issue with some of the CCNSO as well. So it would be useful to say there is an overarching ICANN policy about who is data, and although ICANN has contractual obligations and responsibilities in relation to GNSO, it would be nice to think that the CCNSO took some note of it, because I think it's a much larger issue. And I think the other piece that's missing is the debate that we had today, and I know it was in the conference call, I think, yesterday, and that is the issue of compliance. What do we mean by compliance, and how do we actually enforce it?
Alan, and then Evan, want to say something?
Just in relation to Holly, I think when we're talking about who is right now, we are talking about GTLD who is. Now, whether we should be talking about the wider one and to what extent ICANN has any ability to enforce it or even recommend it, interesting questions. I think it's useful to think about how we got where we are today. We have all sorts of things related to who is that are in contracts. We have other things where who is silent, that we have never put it in words. We have the major problem, as discussed in our previous session or session two ago, of there are aspects of who is that are well-defined and totally ignored. And compliance is one of those issues. And I've just lost my train of thought. And really, the challenge is to put it all together in a way that makes some sense. We have to unify bring together the parts we have. We have to fill in the gaps, and then we have to make sure we actually follow the rules that we've just written. Okay. And lastly, remember, as we're writing rules, there are competing issues here. We have privacy versus access to information that are just head-on butting heads. And we are going to have to make compromises in some cases. In other cases, we'll have to have somewhat convoluted rules, because we do have competing issues that cannot be ignored. All of the issues are important to parts of our community.
Yes, sir. I'm going to again remind you that the draft statement of UWRT is up there. And if you notice, most of those issues were taken up in that draft statement. Holly, as promised, made one recommendation that was missing, and I thought it would be useful to add to it. Holly, please add it so that everybody can see what you're talking about. I think it makes sense to have it there. And we have to finalize the statement this week for voting. So in the event that you look at the statement and you think it does not pretty much cover everything that we should say, please make sure that you put it up there, and then we will try our best to incorporate in the statement before it gets to ALAC. Evan, you want to say anything, and I think the chair wants back his gavel.
Okay. I just wanted to expand on what Holly had said earlier. This is not the G-ALAC. This is the ALAC. We have an oversight over everything that ICANN does, and although it doesn't have authority over every CCTLD, at least perhaps has an obligation to publish standards, and even if they can only be optional standards, something that would make at least a best attempt to keep everything in line. Carlton is chair and producer of the statement. Right now, I don't, if I recall correctly, it doesn't go into CCs. It basically deals with generics at this point.
Yes.
In the short term, is it worth examining the higher issue, or is that just something we should keep going as a higher goal? There's an immediate issue of this statement to go out, but I also want to make sure that we don't lose track of the fact that ALAC has a bylaw mandate to look over all of ICANN and not just the Gs.
Yes, I think it's perfectly reasonable for us to aspire to the higher level goals. This statement was really in response to the RT report. It might be useful for us to add a paragraph or something to talk about the aspirational objectives.
I'm happy to do that. It can only be high level, but sorry, I'm happy to do that. It will only ever be a high level, but it should be that this should be an ICANN policy, and there should be some kind of encouragement for CCLDs to actually look at, country codes ought to look at the possibility of their own policies in relation to WHOIS accuracy. I mean, I don't think there's anything more we can say at this point, but at least to flag that down the track we're looking at it.
Yes, Ollie, thank you. That's precisely what I was referring to in the statement we had a conversation about. We have to pass it back to the chair. Chair, you have the gavel.
Thank you very much, Carlton, for running this part of the session. And I gather that the follow-up will be for the statement to be finalized and voted on by the ALAC at the end of this meeting during our wrap-up session. Is that correct?
Almost.
Yes. Okay. Right. Well, thanks very much. We are actually on time, or we're just 7 minutes behind. We are closing this session, and we will start again in 30 minutes at 1600, or just less than 30 minutes, 1600. Please don't be late, because we still have so many things to go through. And Kurt will be coming, so we don't want him to wait. He has very little time as well. So, okay, thanks very much, and we can stop the recording.